Okay.
The marshal may call us to order.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Larson, Judge Smith, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is July 20, 2022. This panel of the court today has five cases on its calendar, two of which will be submitted with oral argument via Zoom, and three of which will be submitted without oral argument solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument is number A21-1640, Arch Insurance Company versus Michael Quistorf. Counsel, I believe you are familiar with our usual procedures, which are essentially the same in the Zoom format. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal argument. Counsel for appellant, you may begin by introducing yourself and your client, and then you may present your argument.
John Mack, counsel for appellant Quistorf. May it please the court. I'm going to reverse the order of my argument, the argument that I made in my briefs, and start out with the argument that the contract itself was invalid. I'm going to start by quoting from the case of McCarthy Wells versus Weaver. Quote, there are other factors in this analysis as the contract is written in fine print or in incomprehensible legal aids. It does not provide clear notice to the appellant. It is below and on the back side of the contract. It is a contract of adhesion as alleged in appellant's argument to the district court. And as even the district court found, the contract violated public policy. For these reasons, the Court of Appeals should either reverse the district court and remand, ordering the district court to find in favor of the appellant in this case, or reverse the district court and order a full trial in this case. Now, from previous appearances before the Court of Appeals, I realize that you don't have the full record before yourselves here. But if you would look at the affidavit of Ms. Passario to the district court filed on July 12, 2002, and look at Exhibit B, because Exhibit B contains a facsimile of the contract. And there are several things that I want you to note about it, if you will. The first page, which my client signs, hardly seems to be a contract at all, and it doesn't indicate to Mr. Quistorf that it's a contract. If you look at the second page, this is the page where the contract terms are printed. It's in very fine print. It's in, there is no signature or initial on the part of my client, recognizing that he is bound by these terms, nor is in anything indicating that he assents to these terms. I think that the McCarthy Wells is directly in point. It's almost the same kind of contractual analysis as that case had. It doesn't include clear notice to the appellant. It is below the on the back side of the contract. It is a contract of adhesion. And the contract violated public policy.
My recollection, I haven't read the case recently, is that one of the main issues in that case was that the type size was way too small so that it was practically illegible. Wasn't that one of the main animating features of the case?
That was one. There are about five others. But take a look at the second page of Exhibit 2.
I have it in front of me. So did you present this argument to the district court, Mr. Mack? Because I don't see a discussion in the district court's order about McCarthy Well.
And in fact, I didn't find McCarthy Wells until Ms. Passario was good enough to preside me with cases that caused me to find it. But I did indicate that the contract was invalid. I didn't indicate that the contract was unfair. And if you take a look at McCarthy Wells,
too, Can I go back? Your arguments about invalidity, it seems to me, rely on the case law about exculpatory clauses and public policy, sort of the public policy as a basis for invalidating indemnification agreements or exculpatory clauses, releases. Am I correct about that?
You are, but take a look at McCarthy-Wells. It also had a case where the argument below was largely on invalidity. The other thing I'd like to say with regard to that is that while I may not have hit the nail on the head when I was arguing to the district court, I certainly slammed all around it on the board. Talked in fairness, I talked about absence of public policy allowing for contracts like this, and the exact nail on the head, McCarthy, didn't appear, but enough did that I argued invalidity below, and this simply backs up my argument as to invalidity.
Mr. Mack, can I step back a minute? Because I'm unclear about throughout this case. I think the district court and both parties seem often to refer to the concept of indemnification, and I think of that concept as meaning like if Mr. Quistorf had indemnified Central Rental, that would essentially protect Central Rental from any claims of liability brought against it by third parties. You know, in other words, if somebody was injured on the Bobcat and they sued both Quistorf and Central Rental, then the value of the indemnification given in, I think, paragraph 7 would protect Central Rental against that. But it seems like what we're talking about here is not indemnification. Simply, it's Mr. Quistorf's agreement to pay for loss or damage to the Bobcat. And that's in paragraph 5 of the contract agreement, which says he agrees in the second line, he agrees to pay for any damage to or loss of such property while in the possession or control of lessee. It seems to me that it's just simply a contractual obligation to pay for damage to the property. It's not indemnification. And in that event, it seems to me that all of this case law, like Schlobohm and other cases, simply does not apply. I'm not aware of any case law that says an agreement to pay for property damage or a loss of property belonging to somebody else while it's in my possession is subject to some special test about its validity, a public policy exception to validity. I'm just not aware of any case law that applies a public policy exception to that type of agreement. Sorry, it's a long question, but maybe if you can provide me with some of your thoughts on that subject.
Well, let me go back to McCarthy-Wells, because frankly, I think it's almost exactly in point. The issue there was the validity of the contract, not whether had that provision been on the front of the contract in reasonable type, initialed by my client, that it wouldn't have been applicable. I think that the problem is that the whole thing isn't inapplicable, and I certainly raised the issue that the whole contract wasn't inapplicable because of public policy. If it's inapplicable because of public policy, then it doesn't matter if the provision involved would have provided for reimbursement, if you will, to the company. I'd like to turn briefly to the first part of my argument. Is there a question? I'm sorry.
Yes. How would this be different than, a car rental agreement?
Usually in car rental agreements, the lessor is sophisticated enough to do two things. One, to make sure that the contract and its provisions are on the front of the contract. If they aren't, I'd be making the same argument. Second, and this is kind of important, regarding public policy. If you try to rent a car, the first thing that the rent-a car agency will tell you, if it's a responsible agency, is that you have available insurance. And if you choose to buy the insurance, then you're protected anyway. That didn't happen here. There's no indication on either the contract itself, and I'm referring to contract, of course, what we know what we're talking about, indicating that he had the right to apply for insurance, to obtain insurance, or that insurance was even available. That's a very strong difference between the typical auto policy or the auto rental policy and this one. The other thing that's very troubling about this case with regard to the public policy issue is there's nothing on the face of the contract itself that indicates that it's either a contract or an agreement. If this had been on the first page, if he had initialed it, there would have been an argument, but there isn't. He doesn't know that he is setting himself up for real trouble in the event that, for whatever reason,
Counsel, I'm looking at the first side of the contract. I mean, it does say on the front side of the contract that this equipment is received subject to the conditions on the reverse side. So, yeah. There certainly is language on the front side of this contract that would indicate that there are terms on the back that should be read, correct?
Very weakly, though, because he doesn't initial that. There's no indication that he's aware of that, nor no indication that that this contract of adhesion is discussed. So while there might be some hint that he should look at the backside, this comes in a packet, and you tear it off, and you say, sign here. And that's one of the problems with issues like this, that it is unfair. Furthermore, the other things that are talked about in McCarthy, there's no doubt that this is in much finer print than what you see on the other side. There's no doubt that much of this is legalese. It doesn't indicate to him that he might contract a lawyer, and it's a contract of adhesion. So I submit that there's enough wrong with this. And another very important thing, by the way, which I forgot, it doesn't tell him that he could be potentially subject to a subrogation right. Once the rental company gets the property back, it applies immediately to Arch Insurance and then burns down the Bobcat. And this goes to the second part of my argument. Arch Insurance, a subrogation claim is only as good as Central Rentals' claim. Central would have been barred from recovery because it exfoliated the evidence without informing Mr. Kristoff. The basic reason the district court discounted the exfoliation evidence is it believed that it would have been futile because the contract covered it. If the contract doesn't cover it, if you agree with my first argument, then the basis for the futility claim is that the contract precluded a defense on the merits. If the invalidity of the contract was a viable argument, then the spoliation claim should have been viable. At the very least, it would have been something for the jury to consider. The spoliation claim was viable and should have been tried by a jury. The Bobcat was destroyed before Mr. Kristoff had an opportunity to inspect it or have it inspected. Mr. Kristoff was not informed that he had a chance to inspect it before it was destroyed. It was also before settlement with Arch and before either Arch or Kristoff could have had it independently.
Mr. Mack, I'm looking at on page 7 of the respondent's brief in a footnote. There's a reference to an affidavit from the owner of Central Rental regarding his attempts to provide notice to Kristoff before the Bobcat was sent to salvage. Is that fact in the record, and is that a disputed fact?
I don't think the fact is in the record, and there's no indication from my client that he ever received such notice.
Is that fact in the record, your client's disagreement with that?
No, but there's no indication from the other side indicating that the letter was ever received either, and it wasn't sent registered mail.
Thank you.
Mr. Mack, did you raise the spoliation claim in your response to the summary judgment motion, this second summary judgment motion? When I was reading the submissions, it does appear that you made that in response to the first motion for summary judgment, but not the second.
I think I argued it orally, though. So I indicate, and it was before the court. The spoliation argument was before the court. The second summary judgment motion was directed almost entirely to the contractual provisions.
Do we have a transcript of that hearing?
I believe you do, but I'm not sure. I know I asked for a transcript of one of the hearings, and that, of course, delayed the my requirement to respond within 30 days of the filing. That's all I have, unless there are questions.
I don't have any.
It appears there are no additional questions for you. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal, as I said earlier. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and present your argument.
Yes, good morning. Cara Pissarro here on behalf of respondent Arch Insurance as the subrogee of Centra Rental, Inc. The district court correctly determined that Arch was properly subrogated to its insured with respect to the payments that it made in connection with the fire loss to this bobcat. And the district court also correctly determined that Quistorf was contractually obligated to indemnify Center for the damage that occurred to the bobcat, where the contractual indemnity provisions in the rental agreement are unambiguous and not contrary to public policy.
Ms. Pissarro, can you respond to my earlier question about the meaning of the term indemnify? What do you mean by indemnify in this case?
Well, actually, the rental agreement itself in paragraph 7 invokes the word indemnify, and that's why I have referred to that provision in the rental agreement as an indemnification provision. We can call it an exculpatory clause instead. I think there's a distinction here because clearly Center Rental is not asking to be held harmless or indemnified for its own fault. It's simply seeking indemnification for any losses to the rented property that occur during the possession or control of the lessee, which is undisputed here. And as a result, Art is entitled to a judgment from Mr. Quistorf in the amount that it paid for the fire loss, and which is exactly what the trial court granted here.
So is paragraph 5 of the agreement an adequate basis for the district court's judgment?
I think that there's a distinction in the language in paragraph 5, although that is also a second. There are multiple indemnification provisions in this rental agreement, both paragraph 5 and paragraph 7. The only distinction.
Well, just to be clear, I mean, the word indemnify is used in paragraph 7. I don't think it's used in paragraph 5. Paragraph 5 in the second clause simply says, lessee agrees to pay for any damage to or loss of such property while in the possession or control of lessee.
Right. So,
and also, by the way, I don't think it's an exculpatory clause either. It's not trying to, we're not concerned with Center Rental trying to avoid liability for its own conduct. Its own harmful conduct towards Quistorf.
Right. So if it's not an exculpatory provision and it's not an indemnification provision, then can we agree that it's a hold harmless provision?
Well, I'm just asking. I mean, my questions were, I guess really the essence of my question is whether paragraph 5 is an adequate basis and perhaps the most applicable of these provisions. And I'm asking because I know that lawyers often specialize in certain areas and they often understand terms of art in a way better than generalists do. And so I always want to benefit from that knowledge. But so I'm just wondering if the term indemnify or indemnification has a broader meaning that and whether it properly applies to this case.
Right. Okay. Have I adequately addressed your concern?
I think so. You may proceed.
Okay. So I would like to point out that the appellant has raised a number of arguments on appeal that were not raised to the trial court, and thus under the Dykes and the Thiel decisions, those arguments were waived and should not be considered by this court. And then I'd further note that the McCarthy-Wells decision that's been discussed extensively this morning was not cited to the trial court, was not cited to this court in the appellate briefing, and was raised for the first time today. So the font size argument, the lack of initialing on the reverse side of the rental agreement, these are arguments that we're hearing for the first time today, and they should not be considered by this court. I'd also know that
there I think was- they were in the reply brief. Is that right? Or maybe I'm mistaken. I'm sorry. I interrupted you. McCarthy Wells is cited in page 5 of the reply brief, but understood. You may proceed.
There was a transcript of the oral arguments, and the spoliation argument was not raised to the trial court in oral argument either. More fundamentally, I think that spoliation of the Bobcat really doesn't preclude enforcement of the rental agreement provisions here. As the court noted, actually it was the appellant that included the Danielson affidavit in his appendix, where Mr. Danielson, the owner of Center Rental, provided an affidavit to the court indicating that he had made efforts to contact Mr. Quistorf after the fire and before the Bobcat was sent to salvage. So I think that perhaps precludes a spoliation finding. But furthermore, I would note that Mr. Quistorf did have an opportunity to have the Bobcat reviewed by the expert of his choosing. He had called the fire marshal because he suspected arson as a possible cause of the fire. The fire marshal came out to the fire scene and did examine the Bobcat and then issued a report wherein he determined that the most likely cause of the fire damage to the Bobcat was the unextinguished burn pile that was in close proximity, but also that he could not rule out an electrical cause as a possible cause of the fire. So in this instance, I don't think that the cause of the fire is at all affects the ability to apply the indemnification provisions in the rental agreement.
Counsel, I guess this is, so let's just say hypothetically under this contract that the, Center Rental did some mechanical work on the Bobcat and did that in a negligent way that when the Bobcat went to Mr. Quistorf's property, it did cause the fire. Under this contract, is it your reading that Mr. Quistorf would still have been responsible for the loss of the Bobcat?
Yes, I think so. Because of the disclaimer provision in paragraph 3 of the rental agreement, where it disclaims any warranty of the condition of the Bobcat, and especially as it relates to any latent defects. But again, it's incumbent upon Mr. Quistorf to prove those types of things. And he was given the opportunity to examine the Bobcat, but didn't. So recall, in instances where there is a finding of spoliation, what is the remedy? Usually the remedy is an adverse inference instruction here. I don't think that even if there had been spoliation here, and the cause of the precise cause of the fire was indeterminate, that precludes enforcement of the provisions of the rental agreement. So the other argument that Mr. Mack has made for the first time on appeal is this willful, wanton, illegal acts, intentionally tortious type argument.
I guess I'm more concerned with, part of the argument that's been made here is that, I do think that there's a gap in this contract, right? I mean, there's, if there's a manufacturing defect, I think that you make the argument that Mr. Quistorf's issue is with Bobcat and not with Center Rental, or if the there's a issue with the Bobcat that's caused by Mr. Quistorf, he's responsible for that. It's not clear to me under this contract if, you know, it was Center Rental's negligence that caused this fire. It's, I mean, it seems to me that your position is Mr. Quistorf would still have been responsible for that, even though Center Rental would have been the one who caused the fire, in my hypothetical, admitting that these are not facts in the record.
Right. Yeah, I think that's exactly what I'm saying. I mean, I would invoke paragraph 6 of the rental agreement as well, where it indicates that the lessor is not liable for any loss or damage of any kind resulting from defects in the leased property. So, you know, under the hypothetical that we've been discussing, where Center Rental's own maintenance activities may have caused something that caused something that caused the fire, I think that that paragraph 6, again, absolves Center Rental and puts Mr. Quistorf again on the hook for any damages that result to the Bobcat while it's in his possession or control.
Thanks, counsel.
So I just would note that as it relates to the intentionally tortious argument that this was not alleged, this was not an argument that was presented to the trial court. As a result, there was no evidence in the record that would support this, that would give rise to a question of fact, which would preclude enforcement of the rental agreement under an unconscionability type argument. Mr. Mack has also made a number of sort of technical arguments as to why the rental agreement should not be enforced in this instance, where he argues that Arch Insurance is not properly subrogated. The first argument he made is that Mr. Quistorf is not a tortfeasor here, and there needs to be a tortfeasor before there can be subrogation. The holding in the Medica case precludes that finding. He makes a timeliness argument and invokes a Pennsylvania case in which he says that it was unfair for Arch Insurance to assert its subrogation interest 3 years or so after the fire had occurred. That Pennsylvania case is a medical subrogation case. It has no bearing on this case and is not precedential. He makes a no notice type argument and invokes group health. And again, that was a personal injury case involving a settlement with a tortfeasor. Here we have no settlement with a tortfeasor. So the holding in group health simply doesn't apply here. I think that the only sort of provision that would preclude Arch Insurance from seeking subrogation in this instance would be a waiver of subrogation provision in the rental agreement, which we clearly do not have here. Mr. Mack also makes a number of what I call rhetorical arguments, saying that it's absolutely unfair for Mr. Quistorf to be held to the provisions in this agreement, that he that somehow there was a duty of Center Rental to explain to him the ramifications of the provisions of this contract. There's no authority for that whatsoever. And then he says that Center Rental should have sold Mr. Quistorf some insurance or offered him insurance, just because, you know, the national car rental companies are able to do that. They've made the business decision that makes sense to offer insurance or supplemental insurance to folks that are renting them, doesn't mean that the mom and pop rental place in Sauk Center, Minnesota has some kind of an obligation to offer insurance to the folks that come and lease the equipment. I mean, Center Rental could not lease a $40,000 Bobcat to folks for a few hundred dollars without some sort of contractual risk transfer provision. It just would be an untenable business model if someone could rent a Bobcat, have it be burned, to the extent that it's a total loss, and then just drop the keys off and walk away. That's unfair and untenable for Center Rental. I would also point out that the trial court applied the seminal case on enforceability of exculpatory and indemnity provisions, which is the Schlobohm case, And he determined that this was not a contract of adhesion, that the rental of a Bobcat is not an essential service. And as a result, he determined correctly that the provisions in the rental agreement are clear, unambiguous, not contrary to public policy, and enforceable as a matter of law, which means that Arch Insurance was entitled to the judgment that it got for the amounts that it paid for the fire loss that occurred here. And unless the court has any other further questions,
I have one question, Ms. Pizarro. Yes. Are you aware of any case law that applies a public policy test, such as in Schlobohm, to the type of language in paragraph 5 that simply says agree to pay for any damages to or loss to such property? Is there case law saying that that type of agreement could be invalidated on public policy grounds?
I am not aware of any controlling case law that has addressed language that that mirrors the language that's present in paragraph 5. But I would say, you know, again, I have invoked, and the appellant also invoked, the language in Schlobohm, which is, I think, probably, you know, the most controlling precedent that we have to scrutinize the language in an agreement like this and find that, you know, its application is not contrary to public policy.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you for your argument, Ms. Pizarro.
Thank you.
Mr. Mack, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Please look at page 1 of the contract and the matters referred to by the other side. And the provision that says equipment received subject to conditions on reverse side, there are no warranties of merchantability or fitness, either express or implied, which extend beyond the description of the face hereof. Two things. That is in smaller type than virtually everything on the first page. So that is a case where McCarthy applies too. And then if we look at the second page, that is in very, very small print and obscured. And that applies to McCarthy too. The language involved, I was not contending that the rental company did anything wrong, but I did contend that we had the right to at least determine whether it did anything wrong. And furthermore, the argument that it could have been applicable to negligence on the part of the Central Rental Inc.'s side is problematical. Suppose, to use an extreme example, Central Rental had thrown a hand grenade at the Bobcat. Obviously, if you look carefully at the language of Central Rental's agreement, paragraphs 5 and paragraph 6 would seem to apply to it. And there's a real public policy argument against disclaiming all kinds of negligence, including your own negligence. Going to the fire marshal issue, the fire marshal did come out and look at the Bobcat, but said it might be due to electrical problems. At that point, then, that could have been the fault. I'm not saying it was, but at least we had the right to check it out with our own person. As I say, there's no indication we ever received the agreement or the letter from the insurance company or from Centrum Rentals expert. Public policy certainly should apply in a case like this, where the discussions were so bad. And by the way, I would argue that Ms. Pizarro misspoke, because I think it's very clear that the judge below did indicate that it was a contract of adhesion. And if it wasn't, the judge erred in finding that it wasn't a contract of adhesion, because it very clearly is. I want to talk briefly about remedy. Suppose the Court of Appeals agrees with me. There are three things it could do. It could send it back to Judge Wang saying, please review this in light of McCarthy and the other cases involved, have a rehearing on it, and make a decision. And then it could be reviewed by the Court of Appeals. The second thing it could do is it could simply throw the case out completely, such as the court did in McCarthy. The third thing it could do is it could send it back for a jury trial. The spoliation issue, for example, is a question of fact. We can look to see if those letters were ever received. We can look to see if there and how extensive the electrical work was done on behalf of Central Rental. And the jury could decide whether or not there was any negligence on the part of my client or whether there was negligence on the part of Central Rental, which might stop them from making a claim under the contract. If you have no questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mack.